Hi, I'm Heather Mulder.
And I'm Janice Greeno, and you're listening to Dementia Untangled, where we explore the topic of dementia through conversations with physicians, experts, and community leaders.
Our discussions focus on innovative ideas, practical strategies, and proven methods to guide caregivers along a supportive path.
Hello, and welcome to Dementia Untangled. Thank you for joining us for this episode of our podcast.
Today, our conversation will be with Jenny Nordine, an occupational therapist and certified driver rehabilitation specialist. And we're going to be discussing driving and dementia. Janice, I want you to think back. This is little Janice. She's 15 years old. She's on the cusp of turning 16, and it's time to get your driver's license. I don't know about you, but for me, that was a huge time in my life. I was anticipating getting to drive the car and this sense of freedom, responsibility that came with that. And I think this is common for a lot of people. We hold driving as almost this right to independence, but a lot of times we don't give it the credit it's due for how truly complicated a task like driving is. We use so many different areas of our brain just to navigate to our favorite restaurant. Driving not only is complicated for the brain, but driving is complicated for what it stands for. And now we add dementia to the mix, and it takes it to a whole nother level.
Not only am I imagining little Janice, but I'm imagining little Janice's nervous parents and thinking about relationships. And driving is so complicated, and it can be a sensitive topic, especially when it comes to dementia and family relationships. And we always want to keep in mind that safety is of the utmost importance. Safety for self and safety of others. And I think this transition might be one of the most difficult challenges for people living with dementia. It just seems to represent losing one's independence when they can no longer drive.
I'm really glad that we're having this important conversation today. Welcome, Jenny. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Before we learn more about driving and dementia, I want to learn a little bit more about you. Could you tell us about yourself, your journey, and what led you to connect with the dementia community?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I started my career as an occupational therapist and sort of identified exactly what you guys are talking about with regard to the importance of this level of independence in our communities. And the fact that driving is so complicated in so many ways, and yet is something that we do have as sort of this rite of passage. And so in my practice as an OT and as a certified driver rehab specialist, I could see this impact on our individuals in our community with a diagnosis of dementia and the various levels of a skill that they may or may not continue to have, and the relationships that could be affected if somebody was questioned whether or not they were continuing to be a safe and skillful driver, and if they were not, the really negative effects that could have on somebody. So, you know, taking somebody's license too early when maybe they still do have have the skills in order to continue to drive was concerning to me. But also if somebody was out driving and getting lost or making poor decisions, that you know, really affects our entire community and that individual and their family members.
You know, Jenny, you mentioned driving is so complicated in so many different ways. And with the progressive nature of dementias, there's going to come a point in time where it's not safe for the person to drive anymore. Can you talk to us a little bit about the different aspects of driving and why that can become problematic for someone living with one of these diseases?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, driving is really three different skills that somebody has to be able to demonstrate. And the first one is rarely affected by a diagnosis of dementia. And that really is how someone operates a car. So, you know, using the gas and the brake, being able to steer, you know, it, starting the ignition, using the gear shift, those areas are often not an issue. The areas that we see become problematic really are going to be the second two areas. Their cognition and vision and visual perception, and then their ability to drive defensively and with patience and not having any significant behaviors begin to affect their decision making. So the two areas that we end up assessing are going to be cognition and defensive driving techniques.
This really does sound complicated, Jenny. And I wonder if you can simplify it a little bit for us and just share with us what might be some signs of unsafe driving.
Oh, there, you know, in the end, there's many of them, but it's actually being able to sort of tease out comments that a loved one might make and how that is affecting their driving or the sign that that is stressful to them. So, for instance, sometimes it can be really simple things. Somebody forgets to put their seatbelt on, or, you know, they come home and they talk about, you know, gosh, everybody, you know, I heard two people honk out there today and I don't understand why. Or they come home and talk about that they're exhausted or stressed. These are all signs of decreased skill in this driving task. The other thing is if you're a passenger with this individual, maybe you're noticing that they become easily frustrated or confused when driving. They're asking you for instructions or directions to what might be a familiar location. They are slow to make decisions, for instance, or maybe are driving too slow. So oftentimes people will say, it's, you know, the speed limit is the limit. And I would like to think that we all drive at or slightly below the posted speed limit. But when we begin to see people who are driving 5, 10, or 15 miles an hour under the speed limit, that individual is now impeding traffic and is basically the problem on the road. So if somebody is driving too slowly, that indicates to us that they're having a hard time with their speed of processing. They've basically slowed the vehicle down to a level where they're able to take in the information that they need to in order to find a location to turn or make a lane change or slow enough to be able to read and identify a road sign or a traffic light.
These have been very helpful tips to, I think, just really help notice if driving is becoming overwhelming for the person. I think in our clinic at Banner Alzheimer's Institute and Banner Sun Health Research Institute, these questions come up often around driving. And sometimes it's not the person resisting, sometimes it's the family resisting the taking away of the keys for that person. And I feel like we get common questions from people when we're maybe on the cusp of unsafe driving. I wonder if I could just share a couple of these common questions and get your response on them.
Sure.
First up, what about if we just have someone else be a co-pilot for the person?
Well, you know, co-piloting is something that we see a lot of questions as well. And the whole point of being able to be a licensed driver is that you don't require a co-pilot and that you are an independent driver and can do this task alone. And you know, basically if somebody is requiring this co-pilot to indicate that the traffic light ahead is red and that they need to begin slowing and different aspects of driving like that, the both individuals are really taking a risk. The reaction time and the quick decision making that somebody needs to be able to make is really where safety becomes an issue. And so if the co-pilot has to indicate to the driver that, somebody is moving into their lane, the amount of time that that takes is going to never going is never going to allow the appropriate reaction for the driver. And this really goes into the fact that if somebody has a diagnosis that is affecting their ability to drive, why wouldn't the other individual, the co-pilot in this situation, actually go ahead and do that driving, just to make sure that both individuals are safe in the vehicle?
And here in Arizona, we're a little unique where we have a lot of planned retirement communities or 55 plus communities. And it is common for people to drive around these communities, go to the grocery store, go to church in their golf cart. How about driving a golf cart instead of a car?
Well, there's a few different issues related to golf carts. Number one, they generally don't have doors. They may not have seat belts. So you're absolutely right. We do see this a lot in some of our communities here in the area. But what we really want to focus on is that your driver's license allows you or gives you the privilege to drive on public roads. It really has nothing to do with the vehicle that you're driving. And so if somebody is driving on public roads, that is what their driver's license allows them to do. So it doesn't matter if you're driving a golf cart or, a pickup truck. If you're driving on the road and going to the grocery store, you still have to be licensed just like everybody else would be.
That's very helpful. And then finally, I feel like I hear a lot from our families. Well, they're just driving locally. They're going to the grocery store that they've been going to for years. They're going to the church they've been going to for many, many years. How about if we restrict where they're driving?
And a license restriction is absolutely a possibility. For instance, a physician or a medical professional or, following an assessment with us, we can restrict somebody to for instance, a 5 mile radius of their home, which can be a transitionary period for them. And so that isn't necessarily a bad option. The question becomes, will the individual remember that they have this restriction, that they're only driving locally, and are they able to remember routes or how to get home, especially if there's some interruption to a normal route between home and the grocery store, for instance? And so one of the things that we're always concerned about is that if there's an accident at an intersection between home and the grocery store, and all traffic is forced to turn right to avoid the accident scene, is this individual able to reroute in what is now an unfamiliar route to get either back home or onto their destination? So these are the things that we worry most about and need to assess where somebody is on their journey with dementia.
Speaking of that assessment, you've mentioned the driving assessments that you do. Tell us more about what those driving assessments entail.
So, we often will get a referral from a medical professional because they're unsure if somebody is safe to drive. And they certainly want to know that their patient is safe or a family member has brought up a concern, and the medical professional just is unsure. And so we do a what would be a called a comprehensive driving assessment. That driving assessment is done in two parts. The first part is the clinical assessment, and we're going to look at a wide variety of things related to a specific diagnosis that could be affecting driving. So when we talk about somebody coming in with a diagnosis of dementia, we're going to look at their cognition and vision and visual perception, sort of their general knowledge of driving, those sorts of things. And this gives us an idea of potential areas of concern that we need to look for out on the road. So once we've done this clinical assessment and potentially identified maybe a depth perception issue or a speed of processing issue or, you know, decision making, whatever it might be, we're now going to take that individual and start ask them to begin driving on a predetermined route. So this route will entail specific skills that one might need to demonstrate, and everybody goes on the same route so that one test isn't more difficult than another. So we start in a neighborhood and we direct the individual through this route with instructions like at the traffic light, turn right, or at that next stop sign, turn left. We maintain the route and then the individual is responsible for whatever maneuvers are required to follow that route. Once we get back and have completed everything, then, you know, the evaluator and the driver and any family member sit and have a discussion about that recommendation. And whatever that recommendation is, then is sent in Arizona to our medical review program of our motor vehicle department and to the physician or medical professional to assist them in completing the motor vehicle department form. You know, in Arizona, it's called the medical examination report. It can be called different things in different jurisdictions, but that is the form that will sort of reestablish one's driving skill following a diagnosis.
How interesting to hear how you're using all of these different evaluations to create this sort of cumulative picture. And I love having this neutral third party assessing this in the individual so that the family doesn't have to get so in the weeds around it. I wonder though, could you talk to us about legal ramifications of driving with dementia? Do you know, does this kind of vary across the country?
It does vary. You know, each state will have a medical review program, but how strict or how involved that medical review program varies. So some states are quite involved and the medical community is quite supportive of that, as is the case in Arizona. And so, you know, generally there will be some sort of a form that a physician or medical professional will complete, basically attesting to the individual's medical stability to drive and any recommendations that they might have as far as whether the individual is still safe to be driving, whether they need to be reassessed more frequently because of the progressive nature of a diagnosis, or if the individual feels as if the driver is no longer safe to be driving, then that form is submitted, and then the motor vehicle department or the Department of Motor Vehicles will then communicate with the driver with whatever that ultimate decision is with regard to the privilege to drive.
Is there a website or somewhere that our listeners could go if they're looking for these resources?
You know, I think that the easiest group or you know, experts to identify would really be folks across, you know, North America, certainly, but also in other countries that are members of the Association for Driver Rehab Specialists. On their website, which is a little bit complicated, the website is ADED.net. So that's going to be A as in apple, D as in dog, E as in Edward, D as in dog, .net. And on that website, right on the home page, is going to be a member locator. And you can go in and put in what state or province or what country you're in, and then find local experts that can help. Because really, it does vary fairly significantly. So I would really encourage you to find somebody that knows those requirements, you know, in that local area.
I'm so glad there's a resource like that available. And I'm also wondering, what does a diagnosis of dementia mean for car insurance?
You know, car insurance companies are privately held companies, and they can really, you know, insure who they choose to insure, and, you know, what their charges are going to be, and things like that. But the most important thing I would say is that we generally don't see car insurance affected by a diagnosis if somebody has followed the requirements of their local jurisdiction to be properly licensed. If an insurance company raised a rate or denied coverage to an individual because they have a diagnosis of dementia, but have gone through the proper channels to be appropriately licensed, one might, you know, consider that discrimination. Now, again, the fact is that they can choose who they want to insure. But as long as somebody is following the rules of their motor vehicle department, we generally don't see there being any effect to that car insurance.
You know, now that we've brought up car insurance, it brings to mind for me medical insurance. Does that cover a driving assessment, or how do people pay for that?
Yeah, I wish it did. Unfortunately, Medicare guidelines do not see a driving assessment as medically necessary. So there are no procedure codes for a driving assessment. So, you know, therefore, you know, Medicare doesn't cover the assessment, and neither does other third-party payers. You know, we do see a lot of folks privately paying for an assessment, family members, you know, basically getting together and sort of pooling funds to pay for an assessment for, you know, a parent, for instance. We've even had, you know, places of worship, you know, churches or synagogues that will support a driving assessment as part of their health mission. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways that people pay for an assessment beyond typical health insurance.
You know, the word family has come up often through our conversation today, and those relationships are so important. And for our family members and caregivers, if they're noticing things that might indicate that the person living with dementia is no longer a safe driver, well, how and when do they start the conversation?
You know, I would really always recommend that this conversation starts early, really as early as possible. Because of the progressive nature of the diagnosis, you know, we want to begin to discuss the safety aspects of driving, discuss the economics of driving, even, you know, owning a vehicle, paying for the car insurance we just talked about, paying for gas or other maintenance of a vehicle. So beginning that conversation early is going to be really helpful. The other thing that starting that conversation early does is we can really begin to set up support systems as early as possible so that they become, you know, sort of typical or normal to that individual as maybe their diagnosis progresses. So learning how to use shared ride services like Uber and Lyft, or setting up, you know, grocery delivery services or prescription medications being delivered to their home and things like that. So starting that conversation, even before some of these signs of concern with regard to driving, can be really helpful so that they can be sort of ingrained into that individual's independence.
I completely agree with the idea of starting the conversation on around driving as early as possible. But sometimes, this is a progressive disease. Many people with dementia lack insight into their condition. We're dealing with something where people struggle with their memory, their short-term memory, specifically in their judgment and decision-making changes. For all of these reasons, and even more, what if that conversation doesn't work? Do you have strategies for families?
There are some tricks that people have employed, family members have mentioned to us over the years, like, disabling the car in some way or adding a different notch to the key so that the car key does not start the vehicle anymore. This really is a way to sort of respect this individual's independence or need to, feel as if they have some independence and not sort of be in their face about the fact that they're no longer able to drive. And often this will help the individual with dementia sort of come to the conclusion and understand that maybe this isn't something that they continue to be safe to do.
If they are not getting the picture still, is there a discreet way to notify the police?
Not generally. In the state of Arizona, we do have a form that a community member or family member can fill out. We've already sort of discussed the medical examination report. There's also what's called the behavior report, and that can be submitted as well. Now, the difference is that a medical professional can remain anonymous. The individual, let's just say that a parent is now going to, call the medical review program and demand who took their driver's license away. If a medical examination report was submitted, the physician or medical professional has immunity, and the motor vehicle department cannot release that name. The behavior report that is sent in by a community member does have a name on it, and you do not have that immunity. However, I will tell you that as long as you've sort of done your due diligence and have this person's best interest at heart, the motor vehicle department is not very forthcoming about that name. But that's really why we try and draw the medical community into this. So the law enforcement themselves really doesn't have an active role in this unless they see an issue. We will sometimes get referrals from law enforcement because of some situation that the driver was in that law enforcement was aware of.
Jenny, I know we've touched on these already, but I wonder if you could kind of briefly recap some of the services that are available if someone's not able to drive anymore, whether it's bringing services to them or having someone transport them to services out in the community.
Yeah, absolutely. That support is really what is so important when somebody is not going to be able to move about in the community independently. So we've sort of talked a little bit about learning how to use the shared ride services within a community, having delivery services, whether it's groceries or prescriptions. But there's also community services with regard to transportation as well. So going back to places of worship. Oftentimes, there will be volunteers within the parish that will help to transport individuals to appointments or, social gatherings and things like that, as well as some of our communities. within a city or a village, for instance, if you contact their services, they will often be able to pair an individual with, a neighbor or somebody close by that has volunteered to provide transportation services. That is really something that I would encourage people to look for within their community, calling the Chamber of Commerce, things like that.
Jenny, this has been a really helpful conversation today. I wonder, before we close, could you give us your final thought when it comes to driving and dementia?
You know, I think that this is a really difficult transition for so many of our older adults in our communities. It because of the progressive nature of dementia, we often are unsure as to when is the appropriate sort of entry point to begin to discuss this issue. And oftentimes, because it's a difficult issue, it is delayed. And oftentimes we don't see somebody until they're really unsafe to be driving. So I would really just encourage caregivers to not always take the wheel or offer to drive. As soon as we begin to see, a parent or somebody saying, "Hey, why don't you drive us out to lunch?" Or, "Why don't you drive when we go to the doctor's office?" Because we really do want to keep an eye on how this individual is driving and if their skill is still up to where it needs to be. One of the things that we didn't really touch on is when you start to see dings or nicks on the vehicle itself, or maybe on the wall in the garage and things like that. Those are all sort of signs that somebody is concerned about their driving, whether or not they cognitively can acknowledge that they're worried. They understand that they don't want somebody else to be watching them drive.
Today, our conversation has been with Jenny Nordine, an occupational therapist and certified driver rehabilitation specialist. We appreciate you helping us untangle driving and dementia.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Jenny. I particularly loved how you encourage people to talk about this early and often, and then get out there and find out about those community-based supports and services. So, thank you also, Heather, for another great conversation. And thank you to you, our listeners, for joining us. If you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast. I'm looking forward to our next conversation on Dementia Untangled. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Dementia Untangled. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dementia Untangled is hosted by Heather Mulder and Janice Greeno, produced and edited by Amber Ayers, and is brought to you by Banner Alzheimer's Institute and Banner Sun Health Research Institute. We are supported by generous donations to the Banner Alzheimer's Foundation.
Please visit our website at banneralz.org and follow us on Facebook to learn about upcoming events. If you have questions or comments, please email us at dementiauntangled@bannerhealth.com.